Lombardi Line with former NFL executive Michael Lombardi. Now here is your host, Femi Abebefe, on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Welcome back. It is our number two of the Lombardi Line here on the DraftKings Network, presented by DraftKings. Femi Abebefe alongside Michael Lombardi. We wish a happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there enjoying us here listening or watching, or whether you're doing, you know, just a nice little brunch, or you're going out to play some golf or watch the U.S. Open. We wish everybody a happy Father's Day out there, because it's a great day to celebrate all the dads out there that have helped us become the people that we are today. We do have a fun second hour on deck for you guys. 30 minutes from now, VSiN senior NBA analyst Jonathan Von Tobel will join us to break down Game 5 of the NBA Finals between the Dallas Mavericks and Boston Celtics. Then 45 minutes from now, Wes Reynolds of VSiN Tonight and the Long Shots podcast will give us his thoughts on what he expects to see at Pinehurst number two for the final round of the U.S. Open. But Michael, let's begin with the poll that you put up on Twitter in the first hour of the show. Who will be the next quarterback to beat Trevor Lawrence's new deal? Now, we have some early results coming in here. We can report the early numbers. This is like election night. Jordan Love is 38.3% leading the way. Dak Prescott is at 27.8%. Tua, 21%. And then none of the above, these were the write-in options, is at nearly 13%. And those write-ins are interesting options. We've seen a few Brock Purdy's in the mix, maybe Josh Allen. What are your thoughts from the early polls here, Michael, on who will be the next QB to beat out Trevor Lawrence's deal?
I think it'll be Tua, but I thought somebody in the comments made a great commentary about it could be Matthew Stafford, and they could be right. I mean, Matthew Stafford's not sitting idly by, right? Matthew Stafford knows that he has significant leverage. Right. Like, you can't do Brock Purdy's deal. How many times do you have to tell people this? Right. He's on a rookie contract. You have to wait until the fourth year to get it done. You go 4 years and then you could do it. It's like guys trying to tell Micah Parsons to hold out. Well, he can't. He's in the fourth year of the deal. If he was in the option year, he has a little bit more leverage, but he doesn't. Right. So, you know, he still can get fined, but he does. He has leverage. You can redo the deal at that point. I don't understand why people don't understand the rules. Like, it's not that complicated, okay? So, that being said, I mean, we know Tua's in there. Tua's going to look at this deal and say, the market, the market, the market. He's right, the market, right? And again, it's not about what do we get average per year. It's about what are we going to get in terms of percentage of the cap. That's the key number.
And I think that's where it goes back to the question that I asked you on the GM Shuffle earlier this week. We encourage everybody to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It's these teams that get these deals done early, it feels like they're able to at least make this a little bit more cap friendly than versus the teams that sort of wait until the 11th hour, like the Dallas Cowboys have done with Dak, like the New York Giants with Daniel Jones, and that how that kind of worked out there to where now he's taking up a big percentage of the cap. Well, it's like if you wait, you pay a little bit.
Well, if the Giants would have franchised him last year and just tried to get Barkley's deal done, just flip that, right? If they wouldn't have franchised Barkley, and if they would have franchised Jones and said, okay, Daniel, 1 year, sign the deal, and then we're going to go sign Barkley, or let him be a free agent and sign him to an economic deal based on the market, which could have been smart too. I thought they just did a horrible job of that. Jerry's in a trap position because, you know, Dak can keep saying no. One of the things you gain strength in any negotiation is really a very simple two-letter word, no. No, I'm not interested. I'm not interested. No, no. You don't want to do a deal? No, I really don't. I want to wait. No, I want to wait. The market's going to change. No, I don't. And everybody knows the market does change. We see it, right? It's not going south. We're not going to have a problem. It's what the Saints have built their cap on for years. That every year they're going to go up in cap. Mickey Loomis has run his team to where he's borrowing on next year's money, and he always gets saved at the 11th hour by new money. You can't call it, you know, luck. It's a strategy. He knows the cap's going up. So for Dak, why would Dak do a deal? And Jerry knows it. Unless Jerry's willing to pay 60 a year or something like some ridiculous number, because Dak has shown no propensity at all to want to do a friendly deal. Well, I'll just take 45 a year. No. Dak, as Melfi told Tony Soprano, he wants to eat all the ravioli. He wants to eat all the rigatoni. He's coming. So, I'm not faulting him for that. I'm not saying that as a negative toward Dak. I'm just saying that's the deal. And I think as long as he'll do that, it's hard to become cap friendly. But what we do know is, and I wrote about this week on VSiN, is anytime the quarterback gets above a 15% threshold on average on cap allocation, they've yet to win. Mahomes was the first quarterback in the history of the NFL since Steve Young. Steve Young was at 13% cap allocation, 13% of the cap allocated to him. Last year, 17-point change was allocated to Mahomes. That was the first time they won it. It's hard to do. I mean, when you think about the top five quarterbacks in terms of allocation in the league are, you know, Murray's fifth, Daniel Jones is third, you know, and the fourth, Dak is second. I mean, we're not winning any games with that allocation. I mean, Jalen Hurts is at 6-7. Daniel Jones at 18. How are they winning with that?
And one team just happens to beat up the other team every time they seem to play with the Eagles and the Giants. So, yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense from a team-building standpoint, but those are the situations that the teams have put themselves in. Jordan Love is in the lead, at least. The poll's still active for another hour. We encourage everyone at M. Lombardi NFL to participate in it if you haven't done so already. Jordan Love at 37.8% right now. What's the percentage chance that Jordan Love gets a deal done this offseason? Do you think that there's something that could be going there?
Well, I think Jordan Love's agent doesn't want to do a bad deal. And I don't think the Packers want to pay a market deal without having enough games. I think they want to pay him. I think they would like to grow into a contract. I think the agent in this case probably, unless there's a lot of guaranteed money coming at him, is probably saying to himself, let's let this market go. We know what the franchise number is. We could play that game with them. Look, they have the leverage. Now, the leverage goes away when the ball gets kicked in the air and injuries can come into play. But right now, it's not a problem. It's the reason why, and not to jump around here, why did T. Higgins sign his contract now? Nobody answered that, right? Why? Well, because if he would have signed it 2 weeks ago, he would have got fined for not coming to camp. If he signed it a month ago, he wouldn't have been in the OTAs, right? But he signs it today. He's fully guaranteed for skill and injury, smart. And now he just does – all he has to do is come to training camp. So you have to understand the dynamics of when to sign and when not to sign. Like, signing right now, unless it's the right deal or unless there's a deadline put onto you by a team – there's no contact until September 10th or whenever the hell we're going to play.
Yeah, because T. Higgins, he's unlikely to be playing in the preseason based on the history of the Cincinnati Bengals and how they treat preseason.
Playing.
He'll make roughly $21.8 million on this one-year deal, all of it guaranteed, which, I mean, that's, you could do a lot worse than $21.8 million guaranteed for one season and what he's doing. And Ja'Marr Chase, he showed up to the minicamp because he doesn't want to get fined as well. It's interesting. Some guys, in my opinion, being smart about it, just try not to get fined, while others, Ayuk or the guys that have missed the mandatory mini camps, it's like, why would you just voluntarily give up $150,000 or whatever it ended up being? Like, this seems weird to me. I mean, I get that they have a lot of money, but I don't care, man. $150,000 is still a lot of money, regardless how much money you're making.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. They give it up, but if you don't pay them per diem the right number down to the nickel, they're mad at you. They're like, you're killing me. You're cheating me. But then they give up $100,000 like it's no big deal. Like, it makes no sense. I'm serious. Like, if you try to cheat them out of a per diem meal, you know, the union's going to call you. That's going to be hell to pay. Not that you're trying to cheat them out of that, but I'm just saying they're very protective of their money. But then for some reason, they throw like, it gains you no leverage at all. Zero. You got no leverage out of it whatsoever. Why would you do that?
Give me the money if you don't want it. I mean, it's very strange. You're just lighting money on fire. And like you mentioned, the teams don't care if you're not there for minicamp. It's like, yeah, they would like you to be there. The coach might be frustrated, but the front office that's helping decide how much money you get, they're like, all right, you're not there. Cool. See you at training camp, buddy, unless you want to keep getting fined. And in that case, some guys are willing to go that route. We saw Chris Jones do it last year. But more often than not, players are going to show up when it comes to training camp time because they don't want to be taking on $50,000 in fine every single day. Like, that's a lot of money that can rack up really quickly if you're not one of the more highly paid players in the league. How about Alvin Kamara? He was also in this boat as well, skipping Saints mandatory minicamp. He's set to make $10.2 million base salary this season with just $1 million guaranteed. His 2025 base salary has zero guaranteed dollar. So Alvin Kamara wanting a new deal from the New Orleans Saints. I didn't really anticipate him skipping minicamp, but here's where it sits at right now. When you look at his contract, I guess it sort of makes sense as to him wanting some more guaranteed money in the future.
And he's the only player, Femi, that they didn't go to for a redo. If you look at their cap, okay, and you examine all their top five players that are paid cap, they're all at minimum salary, including Derek Carr. Okay, so what does that mean? They went in, they lowered their base salary, they gave them just a minimum, and then they guaranteed it, right? They guaranteed the number for the remaining of the contract. And so, you know, and then that lowers, that buys them cap room, but it also buys them debt in future years. Like people will say, well, if Derek Carr doesn't play well this year, they're going to cut him. Well, I think based on redoing his deal, they can't. So they redo Lattimore, they redo Jordan, they redo Carr, Ramchek's who's hurt, they redo him, they redo Taysom Hill, they redo DeMario Johnson, Davis, they redo Jawan, they haven't redone him, they redid Eric McCoy, they did Mathau, they did Olivier. I mean, they've done them all, right? Not Olivier, he's under contract, he's a rookie. So Granderson, they did him to lower the cap. They didn't do Kamara, which tells you a couple things, right? He's got, you know, he's not, maybe they think he's not worth doing to move the future. Maybe he is declining. Really a good player. He has $1 million in per game roster regular season bonus and $500,000 in per game bonus. So he's got $1.5 million there.
Yeah, so he'll get that 1.5 guaranteed. But after that, maybe they're setting themselves in the position to go ahead and potentially move on from Alvin Kamara after this season. All right, we'll continue our NFL discussion with Michael's Summer School coming up next here on the Lombardi Line.
Former NFL executive Michael Lombardi. Now here is your host, Femi Abebefe, on VSiN, the sports betting network.
Start betting smarter with a VSiN Pro subscription. You can upgrade to a VSiN annual subscription for just $199. That's down from the regular price of $240. You're going to get the advanced betting tools, premium analysis, expert picks. This is less than 50 cents a day for the next 13 months to become a better bettor. And our NFL betting guide is coming out later this month. That's the big news. This guide is your ultimate resource for the football season, packed with detailed team, division, and conference analysis. Go ahead and head that to VSiN.com/subscribe and use promo code Lombardi to get all this stuff. Promo code Lombardi, VSiN.com/subscribe, less than 50 cents a day. That's going to be a great Father's Day gift for all of you dads out there that love betting on sports. Go ahead and take advantage of it and let us help you out over the next 13 months. This is the Lombardi Line. Michael Lombardi out in the great state of New Jersey. Femi Abebefe hanging out here in downtown Las Vegas. We are presented by DraftKings on the DraftKings Network. 15 minutes from now, Jonathan Von Tobel, our VSiN senior NBA analyst, will join us to break down Game 5 of the NBA Finals between the Dallas Mavericks and Boston Celtics. But Michael, let's continue our NFL discussion with Michael's Summer School. This is something that we've been doing over the course of this past week. NFL teams now officially in summer break. Mini camps are done. Now we look ahead to training camp next month, and we will continue this series with the Arizona Cardinals, a team. I'm fascinated to get your take on the Cardinals because a lot of people seem to think that the Cardinals are on the up and up and they could potentially be a surprise playoff team in 2024. What do they need to get done between now and training camp to make that happen?
Well, I think for the Cardinals, you know, it's interesting. They were so bad defensively last year in almost every statistic, whether it's running or passing, thought their offensive line was not good at all. Now, Paris Johnson, they put him over at right tackle, at left tackle, you know, and they right tackle, and then they signed Jonah Williams, who Cincinnati was happy to let go. I'm not sure they've improved their line, but I will say this. They ran the football. I thought Drew Petsick did a really good job of running it. They're going to change what they do defensively. They need to figure that out. They were just kind of like robbing Peter to pay Paul with what they were doing. So for me, they need to improve defensively. They need to be able to get control, and they need to be able to continue to run the football and find a way to protect the quarterback. I think that's going to be the hardest thing because they struggled to do that. Look, they struggled to do it, and it created a problem for them. And I think as you go forward with this, it's going to be one of those situations where everybody thinks they're going to be improved. Yeah. But they're one of those teams that we talked about, you know, where they played Baltimore tight. Was Baltimore really, you know, was Baltimore up for that game? Probably not, right? And I'm not dismissing them, but I think their four wins, they beat Atlanta, they beat Pittsburgh convincingly, and then they beat Philly. And Philly, they ran the ball down Philly's throat and moved the ball up and down the field. They ran for 221 yards against Philly. The last two games of the year, they ran for 221, 206, and against the 49ers, they ran for 234 and a loss. They scored 29 points on the Niners. We knew the Niners weren't the same defensively after that game. So summer school for them is got to be able to play better defense, got to still be able to run the football, keep Connor healthy, but somehow get production from Murray from the pocket.
Yeah, production from Murray, and then also defensively, they can take another step under Jonathan Gannon, who they seem to be willing to play hard for Jonathan Gannon. Like, we saw what they did the last half of the season last year when Kyler Murray came back from injury. Like, they played very, very hard. And you mentioned the Eagles game that went ahead and swung the NFC East from Philadelphia to Dallas, them getting Gannon's revenge game in Philadelphia in the second to last week of the regular season. So, if I gave you 3-1, which is what the market sits right now, for the Cardinals to make the playoffs, would you be interested in that price?
No, I don't see them as a playoff team. They're not good in either offensive or defensive line for me. I think, you know, and I'm not sold on Murray. I mean, look, Murray had a good rookie year, good second year, made the playoffs, all those things. But I'm not sold that he's going to be the starting quarterback of elite level to win, because I think at the end of the day, people that rush him correctly understand how to rush, keep their ends inside, force him to stay and be a pocket passer, I think it becomes a real issue for him. And so I'm not ready to go there yet with him.
Well, the Atlanta Falcons, who the Cardinals did beat last year, they are the division favorite in the NFC South, I should say. Right now, minus 240 to make the playoffs, a big, big expectations in Atlanta. It's been a weird, to say the least, offseason for the Falcons, what they did with the NFL draft, signing Kirk Cousins, and it's just very strange. Win total's 9.5. They've now broke for summer break. What do the Falcons need to get done to actually live up to these expectations of winning the South and getting back to the playoffs, something that they haven't done in a handful of years?
Well, they got to find offensive defensive linemen. I mean, they have to find defensive linemen. I mean, Calais Campbell was their best defensive lineman last year, and he just signed back in Miami. Now, they're going to tell you Grady Jarrett needs to come back and Omanada is really a good player, which he is, but they have no pass rush. They couldn't create any pass rush. And, you know, Nielsen did a really good job of coordinating the defense. And the reason he did is because they were very good on third down, third best third down defense in football, fourth best in the red zone. You could move the ball on them. The problem was they played really good and made you kick. And so they're not talented on defense. They lack team speed. And if really they have no team speed on offense, they really don't. I know people say, well, you're crazy, Lombardi. They got Drake London and they've got Kyle Pitts. Well, okay. Who puts the fear of God in anybody on that team? Maybe it'll be Moody. Maybe it'll be Rondell Moore. I don't know. But I know Arthur Smith felt like they weren't very fast. And people are complaining, well, he wasn't in 11 personnel enough. He wasn't in 11 because Kyle Pitts is a receiver. He's not a tight end. He was in 11 more than any team in the league, right? Now, to make them a better team, he's got to get Pitts to play tight end. He's got to get Pitts to play tight end. He's got to be Kelsey, because when Pitts is at receiver, there's no advantage for the offense. They put a corner on him and they cover him. So this is going to be really interesting to see how this all works out. They're higher on their talent. I don't see them winning. Look, the New Orleans Saints, if you look at the last five games of the year, and I know that, you know, you're back in Carr, who's very much like Ricky Fowler, are going to play well when it's nothing counts. But the last four or five games of the year, they were very good. For them to be this far behind in the Falcons, when the Falcons have done nothing, when I say nothing, nothing on defense to improve their team. If you want to know about team building, let me just go over this for you. Okay? Drake London, first-round pick. Matthews, first-round pick. Bergeron, second-round pick. Lindstrom, first-round pick. McCrary, first-round pick. First-round pick with Pitts. First-round pick with Robinson. You know how many first-round picks they have from their team on their defense?
I mean, it doesn't sound like they have any on the Atlanta Falcons, honestly. It's like
one. A.J. Terrell. And this regime didn't draft him. Thomas Dimitroff did. One first-round pick on defense. How are you beating anybody? You're just taking other people's. You have no defensive line. When you have no defensive line in football, and if you have any injuries, are you kidding me? It's really comical. It's a lesson in how not to build a team. And I'm not saying this because they didn't hire Belichick. I'd be saying this too. I was saying it last year. Everybody's blaming Arthur Smith for all their problems. Their problems start with Kaiser Soze McKay and work down to Super Bowl winning GM Terry Fontenot.
So the win total is at 9.5. I don't even want to go there. Let's go to the extreme. To miss the playoffs, 2-1. Would you bet that?
Oh, I'd take that. Yeah.
No hezzy.
They're not that good, Femi. They can't. I mean, look, here, if you want to know if they're good or not, go put the Tampa game on in Atlanta, where Tampa gets the ball with 2+ to go and goes right down the field and scores and wins the game. They couldn't rush. Who's rushing the? Who are you getting sacks out of? Harrison, who they picked in the third round last year? Ibiketti? Are you getting first? He's second round pick 2 years ago. Where are you getting sacks? Lorenzo Carter from the Giants? Tell me, where are you getting turnovers from? Turnovers are created by team speed on your defense. Where's their team speed on defense? Troy Anderson, who they picked in the second round? I mean, Cade Nellis is one of their better linebackers. They signed him from New Orleans. Where are they going? I mean, if Bates gets hurt, they'll finish in the bottom third of the league in defense. Now, Jimmy Lake comes in and takes over the defense. He's going to try to put more pressure on him. He's going to try to blitz more, which is then going to create the question is, how good is Terrell? Can he cover man-to-man? How good is Clark Phillips? Can he stay out there? How good is D. Alford? See, it's a give and take. You want to pressure more. Nielsen said this. Look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to play really good in the red zone. We're going to play really good on third down. And we'll force them, and that's what he did. And so he managed the game perfectly.
So where should people put their money in the NFC South? Is it with New Orleans, who's at +340? Could Carolina ever win this division at 11-1? Like with Dave Canales in that year
one? I would say no, but I would put it on New Orleans. New Orleans is always good defensively, and I think they've improved. If Penning can come through in the offensive line for them, the kid they drafted from Oregon State will play in the offensive line. So now they're back to being tackle healthy. And I don't know where Ramczyk is on all this, but that helps.
It didn't sound good on Ramczyk earlier this offseason. It sounds like this knee injury that he's been dealing with is going to keep him out for quite a bit of time and even into the regular season. If they're already saying that now, I don't know if it's going to end well for Ryan Ramczyk there for the New Orleans Saints. But they did address it. Tyrese Fuaga at left tackle. Maybe you could put Penning at right tackle, a guy they drafted in the first round a couple years ago. It's Derek Carr and it's Dennis Allen. I don't know what to do with this NFC South, but we'll figure something out as the season gets closer to the fall. All right, JVT, our VSiN senior NBA analyst, joins us next year on the Lombardi Line.
This is the Lombardi Line with former NFL executive Michael Lombardi. Now here is your host, Femi Abebefe, on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
If you haven't already, make sure you check out Michael Lombardi's article on the Miami Dolphins and maybe their slim chances in the AFC coming up this 2024 regular season. You can get that. You can get some UFL championship best bets. You get win totals from our guy Steve Mackinnon. Of course, MLB best bets, NHL stuff. Everything that your heart desires in the betting world over at VSiN.com. Check it out today. This is the Lombardi Line here on the DraftKings Network. Femi Abebefe, Michael Lombardi. We got to have a conversation about the Miami Dolphins in the future here, because I do want to ask you about them a little bit more. But coming up here on the Progressive Guest Line, it's our buddy Jonathan Von Tobel, VSiN senior NBA analyst. Help us break down the NBA Finals. Check out JBT's work on VSiN Primetime weekdays, 6 to 9 Eastern Time, as well as VSiN.com. JBT, good morning. Happy Father's Day. Thanks for hanging out with us here this AM. Game 4 Friday night, was that more of a blip on the radar for the Boston Celtics, or are there some real concerns as they head back home for Game 5 tomorrow night?
Yeah, no, I think it's a little bit of a blip on the radar. Look, it's a natural inclination, and I didn't think they were going to do it, full disclosure, right? I bet the money line because I thought that this was just going to be a team that's going to be able to do this. But you see that first half start, they shoot about the Celtics, about 30% from the floor in the first half. The Dallas Mavericks shoot over 50% in the first half, Femi. They're hitting a lot of shots. Luka's working in isolation. And then sure enough, you kind of let go of the rope because you realize, all right, like we're on the road. We're up 3-0 right now. Let's get this thing done and let's go back home and close this thing out. announcer. I think you definitely saw that take place on the floor. I'd be worried if they go out, obviously, and lose this game coming up on Monday. But for right now, given the natural inclination to let down when you have such a massive series lead on the road, I think you're not too worried until we see what happens at Boston on Monday.
JVT, why don't we have a game tonight? Like, I don't understand that. Like, why are we watching a game on Monday night? Like, it makes no sense to me at all. I didn't realize the NBA was – I thought it was a weekend sport. I didn't know it was a weekday sport. That's one. I mean, that's a comment. I'm not asking you a question there. But, I mean, don't you think – you know, it's interesting. And do you draw any parallels to this? I know we don't talk hockey on the show, but the blowout last night by the Oilers – when the Panthers have been dominating that series, is reminiscent of the blowout by the Mavericks, and the Celtics have been dying. It seems like the teams wanted to get back home. Do you put any validity in that?
I think so. I mean, it definitely seems like that, Michael, right? And especially it's so interesting having these two series mirror each other, right? Where you kind of see the general thought of these best of seven situations kind of playing out almost exactly how we thought. So, you know, one team goes up 2-0, then you're down 2-0 going back at home. The game, you know, the team down 2-0 in game three's got to show up, right? They got to be desperate. And then, of course, those teams both lose in those spots because, hey, guess what? The team up 2-0 is probably better than you at this point for some reason. And then, of course, you get what we saw at this point too, which is, man, we got a home game coming up. Let's just close this thing out. So I would say it seems like that is the natural thought of what's happening here. And I do wonder, is, you know, look, this is the thing. No team has ever come back down from 3-0 in a series, as we know in the NBA. What is it, 0-156 when you're in that situation? Just because it's never happened doesn't mean it's not ever going to happen. I would say that this is not going to be the team to do that. The Celtics have responded historically well after losses throughout this entire year, and they have suffered very few losses. So I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, Michael, as you worked in a former front office, whatever it is, in athletics, just don't give them a chance, because once you get an inch, and then, of course, some teams will take a mile, and all of a sudden you might look up and find yourself in a situation you put yourself in last year, which was you were down 3-0 in the conference championships, and all of a sudden you're in a game seven where you got to play for your lives. And this is still a team that is led by good players. Luka Doncic, Kyrie Irving. I would say the way they scored in that last game, which we can get into if you like, I don't think you're too worried, because it did play out how you've defended them pretty well throughout the most part, especially when it comes to the assists, really limited those opportunities. But I don't think you're too worried. I think it is the natural inclination to just, let's just go back home and close this out in front of our guys.
Yeah, I think it was the Boston Red Sox who famously said in 2004, don't let us win one. And they ultimately came back down 0-3 against the New York Yankees. We're hanging out with Jonathan Von Tobel, VSiN senior NBA analyst, host of VSiN Primetime. We'll check out all his work on VSiN.com here as he joins us on the Progressive Guest Line. Well, let's spin it to Monday night, Game 5, because you mentioned how Boston has done such a good job of responding after losses. Well, the betting market is kind of betting against them. This was 7. Now we're 6.5 pretty much across the board, total 209.5. Is this a spot to back the Celtics at home in a closeout scenario?
I mean, I would think so, Femi, especially if we're going to start to dip to like -6 or anything. And I don't think we're going to get under that 6. And this is kind of what we've seen from the betting market throughout this series. You know, the market has kind of squarely been in the camp of the Dallas Mavericks, whether it's pre-series, whether it's some of these game spreads, obviously money line spots, especially as we talked about in that game 3 situation. So it's not surprising to see some initial move here in favor of Dallas. So I think that, you know, sit back, you wait, and you see if this thing can get pulled back down a little bit more and you come in on Boston. Because, again, going back to the way they played, right, even in a win, guys, some of the stats for Luka, for example, average seconds per touch in that game, 5.78. He was holding it for about 6 seconds every time he touched the ball. You know, he is scoring in isolation. He only had 5 assists. Average dribbles per touch was about 5. Like, these are some pretty high numbers. We know exactly what's going to happen. And so can you trust that, yet again, are you going to be able to just get these guys to score and carry a massive load in isolation against this Boston Celtics team? And you go back again to even the corner threes. It was a minimal amount of corner threes in that win over the Boston Celtics on, what was that, Friday night. So, I mean, I think that you're going to be in a perfectly fine situation back at home in front of your crowd. We still have yet to see, too, guys. This is the thing that I keep harping on. You have yet to see the nuclear Boston shooting game, right? Like, going into game 3, they were shooting 32% in the series. In game 3, they shot 36%. In the loss, they shot 34%. You haven't seen this team hit those shots the way that we know outside of that third quarter in game 3 where they kind of erupted for a little bit. But it's been pretty inconsistent for Boston from a shooting standpoint. So you go back home, you get excited to get on the duck boats. Everybody out there is going to be fired up. And those familiar sight lines, maybe you start to see those shots go down and you get it. Because I think Boston wins and closes it out. And I think when they win, we see that these things, they can win by margin. And I would expect that happen.
You know, that's what my next question was going to ask you is, to me, this seems like the perfect in-game bet. Watch the first quarter, because I think once the game gets out of hand, Dallas will be in full retreat mode.
Yeah, I think you're right, Michael. And or either way, or you can look at it another way, right? Which is, and in-game wagering, I think, is the way to go generally when it comes to basketball, as you're alluding to, because it's just, look, it's a team, it's a game with 100 possessions, and you can get ebbs and flows, and you're going to be able to get a good opportunity. But Michael, let's say game five starts, you're in Boston, but Luka comes out and hits the three of his first four shots, right? And it's like sick, it's like a 9-3 game or something like that to start for Dallas. You can get a cheap number on Boston in 2 seconds. Or to your point, if they come out and they finish strong, you can lay a bigger number if you think that they're going to put the foot on the throat of the Dallas Mavericks. But I think generally attacking a total or a side in game is the way to go, because more often than not, whatever side you want to back, you're going to get a better number at some point in the game because of the ebbs and flows of basketball.
All right, JBT, I'm going to change the tenor of the conversation here to the Lakers head coaching search, because everyone's been wondering what's going on with this deal. Started out as J.J. Redick. Then we had the Dan Hurley news. He goes back to UConn. Now it feels like we're back to square one with J.J. Redick. They interviewed him this weekend. Do you think that at some point, whenever the NBA Finals ends, we get the announcement that J.J. Redick is going to be the next head coach of the Lakers? And as a better, how should we interpret that news?
So I think it seems like that's going to be the case. What's been weird to me is the whole reporting thing, right? Because like Shams has been like staunch that he's the number one guy, and somebody else might have gotten a contract offer before him. But trust me, he's been the number one dude this entire time. I don't know about you, but when I'm hiring folks, I like to offer my number three candidate first, just in case, right before I go after the guy that I really want. But I think, Femi, I think they're probably going to hire him. I think when you look at this, James Borrego, who's also up for the job, might be more inclined to take the Cleveland job, especially if you have Donovan Mitchell there. And the expectations are not going to be there. I mean, look at what the Lakers have gone through the last few years. Frank Vogel won a championship, got fired. Darvin Ham went to the Western Conference Finals, got fired. You know, it's a job that has expectations up here, but quality of roster to achieve expectations is down here. And I think that J.J. Redick, because there's not that many offers, is going to take it. Now, from a betting perspective, what does it mean? I don't think it really means that much until we know what their roster is going to look like. They still have, I think, 3 first-round picks. They have been bantied about as a team that's been flirting with the Hawks to go and get Trae Young. But I would very much caution anybody, and they're the Lakers, so this is not going to happen. But look what just happened with Phoenix, guys. They traded the farm to go get the third star, and the depth was abysmal. And then you see them in that first round get swept by Minnesota. You need depth in this NBA. You need balance across your roster. You look at the teams recently that have won championships, the Celtics up 3-1, how deep they are. The Nuggets, how deep they were in terms of their starting five and the guys that contributed to that team to win a championship. The list goes on and on. I don't believe in top-heavy teams. So if they go get J.J. Redick and if they go get a big star with their cache of draft picks, I'm not sure for me that would incline me to bet this team. I'm looking a little bit further down the board for some of these futures odds. But Femi, I think we're waiting for the roster finalization. But if they go top heavy, it's not a team that I think I want to back.
Hey, JVT, real quick, want to ask you, first pick in the NBA draft, is it Klingman?
I bet him at 12-1, Michael. So I'm hoping that's the case. And I read up a little bit more at 11-1, because here's the thing, in a draft like this, where there's a bunch of guys, and I don't want to say it's a bad draft, it's just a bunch of guys that are similar in terms of you just don't know what they're going to be. And I think you could speak to this more as a former GM, but like if there's a bunch of guys that are pretty similar in terms of their value in a draft board, why not just take your guy at one? There's no need to try to drift back and risk him not being there. Just take your dude. He's the most sound player that is available in this draft right now. So I think he is going to be the number one pick.
Fascinating stuff. Right now, Alexander Sarr is still the favorite, minus 140. Zachary Risarche, I believe is how you pronounce his name, he's plus 140. Klingon, plus 550. And we're about, 9 days away from the NBA draft, 10 days away? So I think we're going to start to get more of this draft news coming out in a wide-open draft, as JVT mentioned. Likely going to be a surprise at number one. I wouldn't take the market at face value. He is Jonathan Von Tobel, VSiN senior NBA analyst. Check out all his work, VSiN Primetime weekdays here at the network, 6 to 9 Eastern time, as well as VSiN.com. JVT, thanks as always, man. Good luck with the bets.
Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, JVT.
That is Jonathan Von Tobel. Join us on the Progressive Guest Line. We'll keep that line rolling with Wes Reynolds coming up next here on the Lombardi Line.
This is the Lombardi Line with former NFL executive Michael Lombardi. Now here is your host, Femi Abebefe, on VSiN, the sports betting network.
We're this close to crowning an NBA champion with the action heating up on the court. It's even hotter at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code VSiN. That's code VSiN for new customers to get 150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5 only on DraftKings. The crown is yours. Welcome back. This is the Lombardi Line here on the DraftKings Network. Femi Abebefe, Michael Lombardi. Final segment of the show. We thank Jonathan Von Tobel, who joined us in the last segment, helping us break down the NBA Finals. But joining us now to break down the U.S. Open on the Progressive Guest Line, it's our one and only Wes Reynolds, host of VSiN Tonight and the VSiN Long Shots podcast, as well as The Look Ahead. Wes, thanks for waking up with us this morning here on the Lombardi Line. Bryson DeChambeau enters the final round with a three-shot lead. He's at 7-under. Next closest is Matthew Pavon, Rory McIlroy, and Patrick Cantlay at 4-under. Who do you think is best equipped to run down Bryson at Pinehurst later this afternoon?
Well, I certainly hope it's Rory McIlroy, considering I got him in a bet pre-tournament at 13-1. And I do think ultimately it's probably going to come down to those two. I think Ludwig Aubert, look, when you have one bad hole in a U.S. Open, which he had yesterday, he had that triple on 13. If he makes par there, he's in the final group with Bryson. So I think when you're a young guy, albeit a really talented player, when you give up the lead and you fall out of first, I don't think you ever really come back to get it. So, you know, we'll see how Ludwig does today, but I think it's going to be Bryson and Rory. Look, Rory's played beautifully. He's hit the ball great and, you know, done what he needed to do and has played smart golf, but just made a couple costly bogeys, hit a couple bad approaches in which he's hit him really well all week and, you know, made a couple bogeys late because he was, I think, just one off the lead and now finds himself three off the lead. But I kind of think it's Rory because Matthew Pavon, who's in the final pairing with Bryson, he's really like lived off his putter all week. Same with Patrick Cantlay. Both of those guys have been two of the better putters in the field. So I could see that regressing a little bit. This is Sunday at the U.S. Open. The USGA kind of gets a little bit diabolical with those pin placements. And you saw it yesterday too, where a lot of these are really, really good shots. And then they don't hold the green because these greens on the edges are so fast.
Wes, what do you think let's play off that theory right there. What is the final score of the winner?
Yeah, before the tournament, Michael, I said 5 under par, 275, because this is a par 70 down there at Pinehurst. But I'm going to say 6 under. I don't know if Bryson's going to extend this to like 9 or 10 under. I don't see that. So he may get in at even par, 1 over, and still perhaps win the tournament here. But I'm going to say 6 under is going to be the winning score. I don't know if I see a lot of red figures on Sunday at the U.S. Open with how I think this course is going to play.
Yeah, it's the difficulty of the course. No, the pressure of it being the final 18 at a major. The guy's kind of sometimes a little bit more conservative in this scenario. We're hanging out with Wes Reynolds, host of VSiN Tonight and the Long Shots podcast, breaking down the U.S. Open here on the Progressive Guest Line on the DraftKings Network. Well, Wes, we were talking about it during the break, and I want to kind of allow you to explain it to some of the viewers and listeners as well. The relationship, or maybe lack thereof, between Rory McIlroy and Patrick Cantlay, how do you see that playing out later today as the two are paired together in the second to last pairing?
Yeah, they're not exactly best buddies, Femi, for a variety of reasons. And we were talking about during the break. Look, we know Patrick Cantlay has a glacial pace of play. He is one of the slower paced guys. His group was slow yesterday. He and Matthew Pavon and Rory, a little bit of a, okay, get up there and just hit the next shot. So there's that. And then there was the incident at the Ryder Cup last year at Rome where they were against each other in a match and Cantlay's caddy got involved. You know, there was a big hullabaloo about Cantlay not wearing a hat or something, that Cantlay was kind of ticked off that they weren't getting paid for the Ryder Cup and maybe some of the players. It was alleged that Rory did it. I don't think that's been proven. Leaked to the press about, hey, there's dysfunction in the team. And Cantlay's caddy, Joe Lacava, used to be the bag man for Tiger Woods, got involved in it. There was a little bit of a shouting match in the parking lot or where they were gathering the cars to go back to the hotel after the competition. And then Rory made some comments in an interview that, you know, really kind of indicated what he felt about Cantlay. He called him a name that rhymes with pick, we'll call it, and not give the actual name here. But Rory and Cantlay served on the PGA Tour board of directors together as player director. So they have different visions of what the game should be. And there was conflict there. So these guys aren't exactly friends. I want to see how they're going to play together, though, trying to chase down Bryson DeChambeau.
How will DeChambeau approach this? I mean, I got to marvel at the guy because he wasn't very likable when he was real big, buffy guy, right? And now he's trimmed down. I have my own theories on how this all occurred because they don't have testing in golf. So I kind of have that understanding. I've been down this road before. But Big Biff, like, now he's likable again. Like, I missed it. I don't follow golf enough to understand. But how did he become likable?
Yeah, Michael, and you're right. He was kind of the incredible bulk, right? And, you know, always can hit it long off the tee. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he still is the longest hitter of the golf ball off the tee with that driver. But he kind of became obsessed with that. And Bryson was a physics major at SMU, so he's really into, like, the science. And he soaks his practice, his golf balls in Epsom salts and does all kind of really bizarre things. But you know, he has kind of become a little bit likable because he's so creative and he plays kind of a different game than a lot of people. And you saw that at the PGA, like the people were really with him. And, you know, this is a guy, of course, that went to LIV Golf. And not all the guys that went to LIV are that way. I think there's polite applause. There's not like a lot of heckling. But Bryson DeChambeau has kind of become the babyface because he was kind of the heel because he and Brooks Koepka, it came out that they didn't really like each other. And you know, that's when Brooks Koepka was winning a bunch of majors, so a lot of the people seem to be with him. But, yeah, I've been amazed, I think, at Bryson DeChambeau getting so many cheers from the crowd and might have affected Ludwig Aubert yesterday because, you know, it's like, oh, man, the people are against me. This is this kid's first time with the lead in a major championship, only his third major championship, and I think it affected him. And, you know, Bryson and Rory, I think, are the two that everybody's going to be rooting for at Pinehurst today because Rory, I think, is pretty popular everywhere.
It really is stunning after what we saw a couple of years ago when Bryson, everyone would just yell Brooksy at him whenever he was on the golf course, and now they're now cheering him on. Michael may be calling for USADA to join the conversation here in the world of golf, but Wes, before you get out of here, we got a couple minutes left. Who do you ultimately think wins the U.S. Open later today?
I think it's probably Bryson, Femi. I'm hoping it's Rory from a financial standpoint. But if it's Bryson, look, he'll be a very popular champion based on the crowd reaction he's been getting. And, you know, if he doesn't make that double bogey yesterday on 16, this is a runaway. Like the last time the U.S. Open was at Pinehurst with Martin Keimer when he won by 8 shots in 2014. But he responded on 17 with a great birdie. He's been putting very well. So, you know, 3 shots, it's doable. We've seen it at the U.S. Open. We've seen those deficits overcome before, but it is really hard. Like, if you're not, I think, within 3 shots today, so, like, I think the 3-under and the 2-under guys are probably out of it. This is a 4-guy tournament. Bryson, Pavone, Rory, Cantlay. Ultimately, it comes down to Bryson and Rory, and I think Bryson hangs on.
Bryson DeChambeau, -155.
Yeah. It's going to be fun to watch, though. At least it's going to be so competitive. And like you said, the course is set up to where, you know, where if we were going into the Masters, you'd have a good idea that this lead was going to extend. Like, I think it's huddled together. Like you mentioned, one bad hole and it's over with for everybody. I think this will come down to nerves and the putter. And so, like, who have you seen in the last 3 days who has the best putter in their hands?
Yeah, Cantlay and Pavone, I think, of those four have putted the best. All four have putted very solid, but I think maybe with Cantlay and Pavone, that regresses a little bit. I think Bryson's been putting well, Rory's been putting well, but Bryson's been a little bit sharper with the irons than Rory, and that's what gives him the edge, I think.
Final pairing, Bryson DeChambeau and Matthew Pavone tee off at 2:21 Eastern. Rory McIlroy, Patrick Cantlay at 2:10 Eastern. Wes Reynolds saying that your winner is likely from those four players. He is Wes Reynolds. Make sure you check out all of his work. VSiN tonight, also the Look Ahead as well as the Long Shots podcast. Wes, good luck with all the bets, and we thank you for joining us here on this Father's Day, man. Thank you.
You got it, man. Happy Father's Day, everyone.
Awesome stuff there from Wes Reynolds to join us on the Progressive guest line. Michael, you can be kicking the feet up watching the U.S. Open final round today. What do you got planned for the rest of Father's Day?
I love watching the U.S. Open. Usually I have my sons with me to watch it, which is always great, but I'll be by myself as everybody's in different parts of the country, so I'll enjoy it. And hopefully when they get back here soon, we can have a good Father's Day and watch it. Then we'll watch the British Open together. I think that's before they go right to camp. So that is a good time. So enjoy your day, Femi.
Thank you.
And wish you the best. Make sure you get your feet up and get comfortable and watch this whole thing.
We'll be watching. I don't know if we're going to have the backyard rolling or any stuff on the grill, but we'll be watching the U.S. Open, that's for sure. That does it for us here on the Lombardi Line. For Michael Lombardi, for our producer Elliot Bowman, the entire crew behind the glass, I'm Femi Abebefe, saying good luck with the bets. The Handle with Matt Brown and Mike Somich coming up next.